Those German words, awake, awake, tonight is fine. They're a call for us to become aware, awake, of what is going on in our world, what is going on in our life. This morning, we awaken in the warmth of community, in the warmth of worship, even though we are in the cold season, a season when we move inward in our homes and in ourselves, we come together to seek the light. In ancient times, candles were mounted on wagon wheels, which were decorated with evergreen leaves. They were lit during the dark nights leading up to the winter solstice, when the return of the light was celebrated. Christians adopted a similar tradition of lighting candles during the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, celebrating the light that Jesus brought into the world. Each candle stands for one of the messages of the season. Michael lighted two candles for us this morning. The first is for hope. Hope that uplifts our spirits. Hope that gives courage to those experiencing difficult times. Hope for a more just society where racism does not raise its ugly head and everyone is treated with equal dignity and worth. Hope that we claim for ourselves and the hope that we bring to others in this season. Our second candle is for peace. For peace in our hearts and in our homes. For peace in our country and our world. Especially peace in our cities, where people are now expressing their views through march and protest. On the Christian calendar, the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas are known as the Advent season. We sometimes think of this time as a joyous holiday season of parties and shopping. But when we only think of it in that way, we miss the true meaning of Advent. Advent is the time when we are called to reflect upon the journey, the struggle that comes before the joy, the darkness that comes before the light. The story of Advent is the story of a people who have been through a rough time, but have endured for generations in spite of oppression and injustice. They've had their ups and downs, moments of triumph, and moments of setback and defeat, but they've held on to hope for the coming, that is, the advent of a better world, a world where fairness and justice will reign, and peace will come. In Advent, we're at the point in the story when the people know that something is at hand. Of course, what's about to happen in the ancient Advent story is the birth of Jesus, the one who they call the Messiah, the one who's said to bring this message of peace and love and justice. This is the revelation of the ancient story. But we light our candles again this year to shine light on our world and in our time. This is a season ripe for profound revelation. And isn't it true this year, something is being revealed to us. Something's being uncovered. Something that may have been there for years, but we did not pay enough attention to it. But now, we see it with new eyes as new light shines upon it. In the old Advent story, people are waking up to the fact that something powerful has happened. This December, I think we are. We are waking up to what is going on around us. The time has come to see the struggle, the darkness of today, and not deny it, or look the other way, but to name it and own it. But it's also the time to see the hope and reach for the light that always overcomes darkness. times like these of awakening can be painful. The revelations can cause us fear and discomfort. It can even be disorienting. The world we thought we knew may not be the world that is. Hard to understand things about our world and about ourselves surface in these times. But painful as they may be, it is always good to bring difficult things into the light. When hard truth is revealed, when we truly wake up to the situation at hand, when it has really come home to us, we find ourselves in a different place. Yes, we feel the pain, we also feel the power and the need to engage and to act. In Ferguson, Missouri, in New York City, in Cleveland, Ohio, and in many other places in our nation, something difficult is being revealed. Not something of which we are totally unaware, but something that has become so much more clear and urgent. You've seen the failure of two grand juries to indict white police officers who killed unarmed black men. And in the middle of these two events, we saw a police officer jump out of a cruiser and kill a 12-year-old boy playing in a park on a swing with what was a toy. The accumulation of these killings of black men and boys cause us to think back to last year and the year before to those cases in the news, the killing of Trayvon Martin, or 4 years back to the killing of D.J. Henry. You remember the Massachusetts 20-year-old who was a college student in New York and was shot to death by police in his car. And then to the other armed black men and boys who were killed and whose names didn't stick, that we can't recall. We know there is a problem. Young black males are at a far greater risk of being shot dead by police than their white counterparts. In fact, 21 times greater risk, according to ProPublica's analysis of federally collected data. We have not wanted to believe the worst, but we are moving beyond the point when we can any longer see these as isolated, explainable incidents. We feel the connection between them. As the song Mike sang for us asks, how many times can a man turn his head pretending he just doesn't see? How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? And how many deaths will it take so we know that too many people have died? Doesn't your heart say enough? No more turning away. No more blocking your ears. No more explaining away or denying the obvious. The time is at hand, drawing God to something. Just like in the ancient story of Advent, there's been a lot of waiting to get to this point. Black men and women have been waiting a long time for real fairness and equality. Of recent, many of us have been waiting with them as grand juries deliberate for months. The results have been hard to understand and painful for many. But they're a wake-up call. So what is it that we're waking up to? First, I think we're waking up to the fact that we have deceived ourselves. We have, to one extent or another, bought into the idea that with a black president, we now live in a post-racial world, or something approximating that. That we had that struggle, and sure, there might be a few pockets of racism here and there, but for the most part, that's over. Next, we must wake up to the fact that our law enforcement system, be it at the level of the police on the street, the level of prosecutorial decision-making, the level of grand jury deliberations, the level of trials, or the level of sentencing after trials, all are tainted by racism. Just every action and decision made by police and prosecutors in these recent cases can be independently justified for non-racist reasons. But collectively, it still adds up to racism. And I don't believe these events are intentionally planned acts of racism, as has been the case in our history. But I do believe that in the moment, in that split second of fear, many officers respond differently to a young black suspect than they would to a white suspect. What we need to wake up to is that the civil rights movement of the 60s moved us to let go of racism at the intellectual level. Overt racism, codified into laws and government policy, is gone. But the civil rights movement of the 1960s did not bridge the differences and develop the true emotional, spiritual understanding of the equal worth and dignity of folks of color. We did not dismantle racism at the deeper emotional level. We'd like to think we did, but we did not. It's still there. At the level of our fears, it's there. It is in the part of our brain that guides us in those split-second decisions. Ask yourself the question. If you were walking along a street at night, would you feel differently if you saw a young white man approaching you versus a young black man approaching you? Ask yourself. Would you be more likely to think that a gun in a child's hand was not a toy gun if the child was black? We don't want to believe this. And if you are white and have that privilege, it's easy not to see racism. I'm sure some of you here don't believe that Michael Brown or Eric Garner or Tamir Rice were killed because they were black. And I'm sure some of you don't believe that the two police officers brought before the grand jury acquitted because of racism. But wait. What is this thing called racism that I believe is in fact operating in all these cases and in many more? The classic definition of racism is racial prejudice coupled with power. Certainly the police and grand juries have power. And then there's those words, racial prejudice. Don't they mean this? That before you really know what is happening, you prejudge the situation because of the race of the individual. It seems so clear to me that in every one of these cases, the individual was prejudged based on his race, rather than on a rational assessment of the situation. It's hard for me to believe that the same actions would have been taken if the individual the police confronted were white. But let me pause here to say, I am not condemning police officers. I am not saying their jobs are easy. I am not saying that in every encounter on the street can be defused without an officer firing a gun. I'm not overlooking the fact that there are armed gang members who present real dangers to police officers, and that we rely on police officers for our protection in so many situations. In my time as an assistant district attorney, I worked with many, many police officers. I have known those who have shot people, and I have known those who have been shot. And in both cases, their lives have been devastated by these events. The ones I know were never able or allowed to carry a gun again. Don't think there's not horrible stuff on this side of the equation as well. And yes, there are bad police officers, like there are bad anything, and sometimes departments don't do enough to weed them out. And yes, the police need better training around the issue of race and difference, and they need to be more involved in community engagement, and certainly not more militarized. But let's not say that what we are experiencing right now in this country is as simple as a problem of the police. It's not. Every night this week, I have dreamed about my days in the DA's office, something I have not done in a long time. And I struggled with thoughts about when I had worked with a grand jury. And I understand exactly how the two grand juries that reported this week failed doing that. If a grand jury is given conflicting evidence, and they see that the prosecutor's heart is not in seeking an indictment, they will not indict. And I know that so often the relationship between prosecutors and police is a close one. And when the accused is a police officer, the system does not always work well. I was grateful that in the office where I work, most of us try very hard to keep our relationship with police at a very professional level. But truth be told, you could not do your job without them. They were your witnesses. They were your contacts to other witnesses in every case. On many occasions, I personally depended upon the police for my personal protection. And it was always very hard to make a decision other than the one that the police wanted. So why do I tell you this? Because there is a problem to be addressed within the police and the prosecutorial system, and we should insist that that happens. But the issue is much bigger than that. And if all that comes out of this is some civil rights investigation against police officers and maybe some new policies and procedures, maybe even a new law or two, we will not have accomplished enough. We need some deeper conversations. Conversations at the level of our hearts and souls. I wish I could wave a wand and it would all be well. Love would replace hate, trust replace suspicion, and white folks and black folks could truly embrace each other as equal in every way. This past week, I bet you saw the photo that went viral on the internet and was all over television. It's a small version. If I were more technically savvy, we'd have a larger version, but that's the best I could do. But maybe it's enough to recognize what you see. It's the photo of a Sergeant Brett Barnum in riot gear hugging a 12-year-old black boy named Devante Hart during a Ferguson rally that was held in Portland, Oregon. With all that's been happening between police and young black men, I think everyone was drawn into this photo. It conveys a message of hope, and perhaps even a message that, oh, underneath all is well. But I'm afraid also an opportunity for white Americans to feel good without doing the hard work of addressing the question of racial injustice that brought people out to this rally in the first place. Especially at this time of year, I don't want to dismiss individual acts of kindness and love such as that photo depicts. They're very important. But they are not sufficient to address the injustices that are happening to young black men in our country every day. They're not enough. The child in this photo is crying. Perhaps he knows the truth of the problem. Today he's being hugged by a police officer, but tomorrow he could just as easily be shot by one. And who will bear the responsibility? Not just the police officer or the department that trained him and sent him out on the street with the wrong kinds of orders. We all would bear the blame. As privileged white folks, we need to accept that we are responsible for racism. That black teenage boys are on the streets because they don't have jobs or proper educational opportunities. And we've talked around that for years. We need to acknowledge that we collectively have created a racial underclass of people who are not treated as we are by the police or the courts or any other branch of government. It's ironic that as our Supreme Court is striking down affirmative action in education, it's at a time when we need to find a way to raise up and educate and employ those young black men. Have you really acknowledged how much more privileged you are than a black person? Think about it. Here in Stowe or Maynard or Acton or wherever, we live in safe space where we believe the police will protect us and they will protect our children. And I ask you, would you believe this if you were a young black male today in this country, or the parent of a young black male? I don't think so. We need to look inside ourselves and share what we find with others. We need to think about what we can do to change first ourselves and then our society and then our institutions. These protests are not going to go away. Nor should they. Just before the Ferguson grand jury reported their shocking news, I received this little note. It's from the people of Ferguson with whom we had split our Sunday offering in September in order to help them financially with some legal expenses and food for people who weren't able to work because of the protests. It's in a very poor pen, and it's kind of, you can see it, a bit scribbled, but it says, thank you so much for your support of the struggle. We really need it. Our financial contribution was small, but it was some. And it makes me ask the question, what next for me? For us? How do we keep the conversations that open our hearts and eyes going? And how do we continue to support the struggle? This is as much of an issue for us as it is for them. In the words of Martin Luther King Jr., which I'm sure you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Now I know that we are not all on the same page on this issue. I know there are many of us who are feeling strong emotions. It's time to engage deeper on this issue. And to start, I invite you to reflect honestly on what has been revealed these weeks, and on the issues that that revelation raises. Ask yourself hard questions. And if you would like to share your thoughts on racism and what next, please join us as we can come together and do that. We're going to do that next Sunday between services at 10, but perhaps at other times as well. Many have expressed an opportunity to do that, and we're going to provide that. I wish a few hugs, like the one the 12-year-old black boy and the police officer shared to solve the issue. It would make everything better. But I know, and you know, it won't. And a part of me is not very optimistic about the situation. But a part of me is also an Advent person. A person for whom hope is revealed in the darkest times. A person who, in the words of our own tradition, believes in the inherent worth and dignity of every person with all my heart, even when I fall short in acting that way, even when my fears or lack of understanding take me in another direction. I believe that in all the pain of the moment, there is huge opportunity. Things have been revealed in ways that they have not before. And there is new light piercing the darkness. In the Advent context, we are awake and we need to stay awake. Every hug and act of kindness does matter. Every candle lit counts and helps to reveal the truth as well as guide us on the way to the future. I believe what our forebearer Theodore Parker once wrote, the moral arc of the universe is long, very long in fact, but it bends towards justice. The journey is long, but a better world of justice, fairness, and equality is coming. That's the message of Advent. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome racism someday.